the social history of the soldiers under the Mughals. I would like to actually start with an anecdote from a 17th century account, and that is the account of a Venetian traveler, Niccolo Manucci, who has in fact sort of recounted an encounter between a Kayasth Hindu, Hindu scriber, who is a clerk in the Mughal army, and a soldier. So this is recorded by Niccolo Manucci, and he mentions in that in his account that it is about the period of Shah Jahan, when Shah Jahan was the ruler, that a soldier had gone to draw his salary to this this Kayasth Hindu scriber, and then this Kayasth man was busy somehow in the office, and then the soldier goes there, and the soldier is angry about it, that and threatened him, saying that he should have to smash his teeth with his sword. And then the official, the Kayasth Hindu scribe, he doesn't say anything, and then paid him his salary, or the pay that he was supposed to be given, and then said that with his pen he could do more harm with his sword, and not with the sword. So he said that his pen has more power. The sharply witted scribe, to get his revenge for the behavior of the soldier, was that he wrote in the book, in the account book of that soldier, where there is always a description of the role of the soldier in all the documents. So he mentions that the soldier, that particular soldier, has actually lost two of his front teeth, right? That's very interesting. So he mentions that this person, this soldier, had lost two of his front teeth, and then the soldier goes away, the scribe is also busy with his own work. So it was a practice for the Mughal country to write the names and personal marks of those who were employed with the Mughal army. So some months actually elapsed, and then the soldier appears again for his pay. And then the clerk, who is a different clerk now, who opens the book and found that there is a description which mentions that the soldier who is entitled for the pay, he had no front teeth. So two front teeth is not there, and that is recorded in the register, so that is in the descriptive role. So now the soldier was put to the confusion, and his protests and arguments were it was not heard, and seeing no other course, because he would have to lose the salary, so he goes back and then gets his two front teeth extracted to agree with the record, and in that way his salary was paid. Now that's a very interesting anecdote to understand the kind of huge paraphernalia that the Mughal soldiery had, the Mughal army had. Now this, anecdote, when we read with the Jadunath Sarkar's understanding of the military history of the Mughals, he mentions in his account, which he wrote way back in the 1960s, he mentions that the early Mughals like Babur had very well carried out the raids in India, and they had been successful in India because of their raids, frequent raids and lightning raids and ambushes. Now, but then he says that once the Mughals established themselves, they gradually created a big artillery, a big army, a huge army. And then this became a burden for the Mughals. So he mentions about the, you know, the big artillery of the Mughal was too, it was too heavy, too big to be moved during a battle. And the vast, and he also mentions about the huge and, you know, cumbersome machines that were used by the Mughals gradually in the wars. So the fighting force by the fighting force of the Mughals also included these civilians, clerks, accountants, shopkeepers, various kinds of dancing girls, all this. So this number was too huge. So the non-combatant people in the Mughal army were much larger than the actual soldiers. So he gives a ratio, Jadunath Sarkar gives a ratio of 10:1, that the non-combatants are 10, and then the soldier is 1. So after every 1 soldier, you have 10 non-combatants who are actually supporting the functioning of the Mughal army. So the Imperial army, according to Jadunath Sarkar, had become incapable of making the lightning raids. It had become so huge, and there were no night attacks or ambushes, which were one of the characters of the early Mughals. And that is why the Mughal army actually failed gradually in the 18th century. And he mentions that it is one of the reasons why, you know, they failed against the Marathas, who were so very, you know, proficient in all these ambushes and attacks, sudden attacks and lightning raids. Now, I would like you to read these two, the anecdote of Manucci and then the description given by Jadunath Sarkar based on the Persian sources. Because Jadunath Sarkar's major emphasis is on the burden on the Mughal exchequer, right? So he talks about the huge number of soldiers and the non-combatants that led to a huge burden on the Mughal army, the Mughal treasury, and the vast number of people, the transport animals, the enormous quantity of material that ate up the revenue of the state. All this has been mentioned by Jadunath Sarkar. Now, what is the, if we read all these two descriptions, and then what does the Persian sources tell us? What is the actual theoretical potential, or we can say the potential strength of the Mughal army, right? Now, if you read the Persian descriptions, Persian narratives, chronicles, they will tell you that all the Mughal army is such a huge army, and that's how, Jadunath Sarkar stands correct. But we have to read all these Persian descriptions very carefully. And so, suppose, for example, when we read Abul Fazl's description, the theoretical potential strength of the forces under the Mughals, somewhere in the mid-17th century, numbered some 9,11,400 cavalry and infantry. Right, that's huge number, 9,11,400 cavalry and infantry. Now, many later historians, modern historians, like, for example, Douglas Stuyvesant, in his Formation of the Mughal Empire, interprets this kind of figures of the Persian chronicles. He uses it. And he says that the Mughal Empire actually supported a huge cavalry and infantry. So the total number of cavalry and infantry, actually, Stuyvesant in fact mentions that it actually comprised roughly 10% of the male population of the entire Mughal territory. Similarly, we have accounts from 17th century which mention that Shah Jahan maintained some 200,000 cavalry and 40,000 infantry, which included the musketeers, the artillery men, and then, you know, all the rocket men, and then many other soldiers. Now, the questions that we raise while we read all these sources are very straight. Are these interpretations of the Mughal military really true? If we read the Persian sources of the early modern period, the sheer number mentioned by these chronicles would suggest that the Mughals had actually been able to gradually establish a very huge military. But one of the important factors that we should consider while studying the military is the vast demographic resources of South Asia at that time, particularly India. The huge population that India had at that time. So in the 17th century, the population of India has been estimated to be around somewhere around 14.5 crores. So if you read Shirin Mosvi's Economic History of India, she has calculated, given a calculation of the population during the Mughal period. Now, was it because of this that we see the absence of, a conscription? Conscription, conscription is something related to, compulsory state service. So, is it because of this huge population that India had at that time that we find that the Mughals had not come up with this idea of compulsory state service during that period? Because I would like you to go back to neighboring territory of Eastern India, where in Assam you have the Ahoms, who had introduced a kind of a compulsory state service. Now, this is absent in under the Mughals, because here the supply actually exceeded the demand. There was no point in maintaining a big standing army. I think that we have lost connection somehow. Just wait for a minute. Yeah, so is it because of the the huge population I was talking about? Is it because of this that we don't find that the Mughals had followed this practice of introducing compulsory state service? Now, as the supply had exceeded the demand, or is, since this kind of a supply of the soldiers had exceeded the actual requirement of the Mughals, is it because of this that there was no point for the Mughals to maintain a big standing army year after year? And the number that has been mentioned in the Persian sources, are these actually the real numbers? So we will discuss all that. When we look at the, while we do all this study, we also try to figure out the social composition of the military at that time. So far as the historiography of the military history of the Mughals is concerned, one of the interesting books that that was written in early decades of 2000, that was by Josh Comans, that is The Mughal Warfare. It is titled as The Mughal Warfare, Indian Frontiers and the High Roads to the Empire. I'll be sharing the book with you. I'll be sending it to you the relevant chapters. And the other book that we have is that is very important for us is Dirk Kopff's Nokar Rajput and Sipahi, the Ethnohistory of the Military Labor Market in Hindustan. And that deals with the period 1450 to 1850. When you read Jos Gommen's, it suggests that, and if you can, the very title of the book, if you read The Mughal Warfare, this work actually focuses more on, the different contexts of Mughal warfare. And while dealing with the Mughal warfare, Jos Gommen also talks about the origin of the soldiers who joined the Mughal army, from where they came, what was the area from where the Mughal soldiers had come and joined the Mughal army. Now, it actually describes the geographical and, cultural setting while it explains India's importance as a zone between arid and fertile terrain. And then it talks about also, although it doesn't mention about Victor Lieberman's strange parallel, but I would like to bring in that book also in the discussion later on, because Victor Lieberman also specifically talks about the geographical location and how the geographical setting and the cultural setting of the Central Asian had influenced the history of South Asia and various other parts of the world. Now, Jos Gommen explains how the Mughals they mobilized and then they combined the assets of both these regions of the arid zone and the fertile terrains of kind of northern India and middle Ganga basin. Gommen also talks about the frontiers, from where the horses came, and the skilled nomadic cavalrymen who came from these regions who could be employed effectively. Now, Victor Lieberman indirectly also mentions about that the Central Asian people had these characteristics of moving on the horses, and that's how they entered into the exposed zones of India. The heartland has been, for the Mughals, had been the agricultural zones, and that was the area from where many of the soldiers came, which Jos Gommen, like Dirk Kopff, also mentions. So Gommen describes in great detail how all the necessities of military operations were, they were sourced and assembled, how the manpower, the muskets, the artillery and other weaponry, horses, the elephants, all this, and the fortification, the work of fortification, how all these, they were all sourced and they were all done. So this whole process involved more than simple buying or seizing the goods. And he mentions about the complex, social relationships, and basically the social composition of the different soldier communities. So Gorman's understanding is about the Mughal army is mainly about the whole recruitment process, how it was supplied and equipped with different kinds of people coming from different social background, and then how different people joined these Mughal army, why did they join, why the Mughal forces relied on a particular group of people who were coming from a particular region. I mean, these are some specific details that Josh Gomans has given in his book. Now, when it comes to Dirk Koff's writing, Koff actually explains how the highly militarized society that the Mughals encountered in India, this has been explained by Dirk Koff, and he mentions about the different, how there was a situation of constant violence, low level warfare, which required kind of a demand for fighting men always in the rural societies. So there were the Mughals were able to recruit these men in large number, and with the availability of these military labor that was available in the rural area, the Mughals were in a position to hire them. That's what Dirk Koff mentions. So he says that India's military culture actually promoted some kind of social mobility. Most of the groups did submit to the central authority, but only with certain conditions. The state had to sometimes use the force. Rebellions also occurred because this rural army was actually always traditionally been very violent. So all this has been mentioned by Koff, and while he mentions about the military culture that was prevalent in northern India and especially in the Mid Ganga basin. Now, the one of the important points that Dirk Koff raises is about the silence of the bardic literature of Rajasthan on the Rajputs that came from these Middle Ganga basin, right? So he mentions that the mainstream version of history does not sum up the whole of the the Rajput reality. There were huge number of Rajput peasants and landlords in eastern India who were powerful as jamindars. They were powerful as soldiers, but they have never been mentioned by the mainstream Rajasthan literatures. So he questions that, and he says that why the bardic literature, even the bardic literature, do not speak anything about these Rajputs beyond who was beyond the territory of Rajasthan. So he talks about the especially the Ujjainia Rajputs of Bihar. He talks about the Bundelkhand Rajputs. There were a lot of Rajput clans with long tradition of fighting and service. And then he questions that why these Rajputs were never recognized as fit for marriage relationship, although they were They followed the traditions, many of the traditions of Rajasthan, but then they were not recognized for marriage even by the Mughals or the Rajputs of Rajasthan. So they now this kind all this has been raised by Durkoff in his book, and he says that most of these Eastern Rajputs have remained silent in the mainstream writings, although there are regional literatures like Tarikh-e-Ujjaini, I mean, which mentions about the Ujjainis who had come from Ujjain and settled in the Shahabad area and settled there, so and emerged as powerful rulers of in that region. Now these Ujjainis in fact proved to be very helpful in establishing Sher Shah as the ruler in that region. They have also been referred to as the Purabiyas, in many of the medieval texts, and Durkoff mentions about the 16th century chronicle of Nizamuddin Ahmad, who was closer to the period of Babur and Rana Sanga, who refers to the Purabiya Rajputs at that time. Now, obviously, we have various other examples of the Purabiya Rajputs even in later accounts. If we read many of the regional literatures like that of Malwa, we have one of the Purabiya, Rai Chand Purabiya, who had been a very important Rajput commander. In fact, we have examples from many of the regional sources which suggest that these Purabiya Rajputs were hired by various dynasties in different parts of India to serve in their army, and they were called by these different ruling houses to different places. So, like for example, Rai Chand Purabiya, who later became famous as Medini Rai, he is said to have arranged some 400,000 Rajput forces for Mahmud II, who was the ruler of Malwa at that in early 16th century. So we have such account of the Purabiya Rajputs. If you read Abbas Sarwani's Tarikh-e-Shershahi, it mentions about the help Puranmal provided to Sher Shah. So with his 6,000 horsemen, and how then Sher Shah had given a huge ikta of Banaras to Puranmal. Now all this description has been given by Durkoff in his account. Now another very interesting book of dealing with the Mughal soldiers is The Gunpowder and Firearms by Iqtadar Alam Khan. Now this book, although is very interesting in terms of its details, when we deal with the social history of the Mughal army, I mean, it does not mention much about the social aspect, because it deals mainly with the technology, military technology innovations that the Mughals had introduced at that time. How the muskets and the cannons and the rockets, they were introduced. It mentions about different methods, field artillery that were used by the Mughals at that time. So he talks about the various gunpowder technologies that the Mughals introduced. So Iqtadar Alam Khan book is in that sense is very interesting, but It explains mainly the gunpowder technology that matured over a period of time, and then how it played a very important role in the success of the Mughals. Now, obviously the limitation of this book in terms of social history is that it doesn't talk at all about the, you know, the recruitment of the soldiers, the from where they came. Now, when it comes to the idea of recruitment, in order to understand the Mughal recruitment, we need to go into a little background into military recruitment under Delhi Sultanate, because in the 14th century, if you recall, the dominant mode of military recruitment in India was the Mamluk system. Mamluks were basically the slave soldiers, right? So now in 16th century, there is actually a different way of organization has been introduced by Akbar, that is known as the Mansabdari system, but that's a completely different system from what we find in the Mamluks. Now, the Delhi Sultanate depended on the irregular troops, which included the mercenaries, the retainers of the tributary chieftains, and the and also the regular soldiers. So it included the gulams, the slaves, plus the soldiers that were raised and maintained by the iktadars. So basically, you have a iktadari system in existence under the Delhi Sultans. The irregular troops were assembled during the campaigns, and along with, you know, other mercenaries, other emergency requirement that is there during the war. So,
sir, just a question, the regular troops, who maintained them? The state, the sultanate?
Yeah, you have a, you know, that's, there is a regular troop which is maintained under the Delhi Sultanate, and small group of people initially. Under Balban, there was larger standing army created, but, you know, initially, whenever there was supposed to be an attack or an invasion, people from different nobility groups, they were called to join in, and they put all their soldiers together, and then that's how the invasion used to take place. So the irregular troops were assembled actually during the campaigns, and then they, along with the smaller number of the regular troops, used to invade the territories. So the early rulers of Delhi Sultanate, like for example Muhammad Ghori or Qutbuddin Aibak or even Iltutmish, they were largely having these gulams, the soldiers, which they had the idea that they had brought from the Middle East. So they were actually the most, reliable soldiers, the slaves, because they were considered to be the most reliable ones. And then along with that came the other people who joined in. Now, Peter Jackson actually writes about the Turkish slave regiments that was prevalent in Transoxiana and Persia at that time. And he mentions that how they, you know, the early sultans of Delhi Sultanate, they gathered all these troops, which he calls as the shock troops. And they, came together and mounted the attacks. Now, Many of the sultans like Abak, or for example later Balban also, they had also started, you know, their career as slaves. But then Balban went on to establish himself as a powerful ruler, and then he sort of created a, you know, standing army. Now, later under Alauddin Khilji, you have seen a huge standing army being created, where, because there was a specific requirement. Firuz Shah Tughlaq is also said to have maintained a huge slave retinue of slave, like 180,000 has been mentioned, and some 40,000 out of these slaves worked in the army. So there are these details in many of the Delhi Sultanate sources. Somebody wants to somebody raised a hand, I think.
Yes, sir. Actually the question was about this Mamluk system of recruitment. So, sir, I think so. As per Tariq-e-Firoz Shahi, in the reign of Balban, it is said that the Kalb-e-Ala, which was the central army which he created, I think so, there it mentions that the majority of the soldiers were from Iktadars. And these Iktadars were basically single horsemen who could either go themselves for military service, who could send a representative, a servant. So in that, and also in the time of Alauddin, it mentioned that Silhadars seemed to be the main backbone of the army, with Murattabs and Tuaspa as the two main classes. So how much would you say that the Mamluk, the slave system, was still prevalent by the time of Balban and Khilji? Because from our from this text, at least it seems that that more emphasis was given on these landholding soldiers or these wage soldiers who were given wages.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Exactly. Brands. This is what exactly I mentioned, that it is only the early Turks who had these Mamluk system, but gradually, you know, once, like for example, Balban, when he created his own standing army, there were a lot of iktas which were, you know, given, because there were more territories which were captured. And then these iktadars had to maintain their own soldiers. So iktadari system actually, became an important tool to, you know, not only collect revenue, but also to maintain the cavalry troops. So whenever there was some kind of invasions, the Iktadars played a very important role. All these Iktadars were called in. So I'm talking about the early. So you are absolutely right. This is what exactly I mentioned, that it is only the early Turks who were, you know, relying more on the Ghulams. Rather, later on, it is the Iktadari system which became an important part of the Mughal, you know, army. Now the Iktadar had their own contingents of horsemen, right? The cavalry, you know, they have to, so they, the noble, they were granted land, the Iktas, which is, and they maintained a cavalry of troopers out of the revenue that they collected. So they pay, they were able to pay with their with the revenue that they collected to these soldiers. And now we under the Khaljis, even under the Tughlaqs and Lodis, you find that even the non-Turks are being given the Iktas, right? So the Ikta grant is extended beyond the Turks under the Khaljis, Tughlaqs and Lodis. And this is how the Iktadari system had expanded under the later Delhi Sultanate rulers. Now, the Iktadars and their soldiers, they joined the military service basically for the material gain. And there is absolutely no doubt about it. But it would be very wrong to categorize them as, you know, professional soldiers, because they were not mercenaries, because their military employment depended on the political fortune of the Sultan. You know, if Sultan is successful, then they would get the ikta, or they are able to continue with the ikta. And if the Sultan was overthrown, his favorite iktadar were replaced by, you know, nobles from some or the iktadar who came from some other place. Now, overall, if we combine this, the Central Asian style of cavalry, the iktadari system led to the Sultanate military establishment of sort. And that has been mentioned. If you read, you must have read Simon Digby's War, Horses and Elephant, wherein he mentions about the how war horses became an important part of the Delhi Sultanate army. Now, when it comes to the question of standing army of the Sultan, Balban, as I mentioned earlier, he seems to have created his own standing army. And in order to maintain the standing army, he brought in much of the occupied territories under the Khalisa land. And then under Alauddin Khilji, Delhi Sultanate was, you know, as it was faced with Mongol challenges, we know that Alauddin had to create a huge standing army of his own. And in order, just because he could not pay them this entire huge army in cash, he introduced the market regulation system. So, in fact, he was with his strong army, he was also able to invade his different neighboring territories, and then he sought tribute from those areas, and this is how, you know, these tributes actually helped him maintain the standing army even further. So now this is huge standing army could not have been possible with only Turkic and non-Turkic soldiers. So one way to maintain and expand the size of army was to, you know, hire the indigenous mercenaries, and also, you know, he utilized the forces of the defeated chiefs. So the free floating mercenaries had their, you know, just because they had their own horses, they had their own armor and equipment, they were also used by Alauddin Khilji in his army. Now Mughal military actually is slightly different from what we find in the Delhi Sultanate. When Babur inherited his kingdom in Fergana, because he had come from the family of Taimur, he relied on different types of military labor. So, you know, he basically had his own what we may call as a household troops, right? All largely it is the family members, the distant relatives who constituted the core group of Babur's army, and they basically provided the or carried out the daredevil maneuverings in the battlefield. They joined Babur's side because they were from the same family and because they also had clan connections, and they did not change sides despite, you know, the fluctuating political circumstances that was prevalent in Fergana. And they were basically, you know, by profession, they were warriors. They fought for Babur, and they got, you know, even rewards when Babur won territories. Now, later on, if you gradually, when Babur actually moves further towards Samarkand area, you find that Babur was also able to then command the Mongol soldiers. And you know what, if you read Baburnama carefully, you will find that he mentions about his connections with the mother side also. Because Babur's mother was a daughter of Yunus Khan, who was a distant descendant of the Mongol leader Chinggis Khan. So that way he has been able to command the Mongol soldiers. So in Samarkand, when he occupies Samarkand initially, he is able to take the command of some 2,000 Mongol soldiers from a particular Mongol tribe. So the Mongol soldiers became a great advantage for him later on. And so apart from these household troops that he initially had, he now also has the Mongol soldiers in his army. And these Mongol horse archers carried out the flank attacks, which actually helped a lot in his in different wars that he fought. So they played a very important role in many, in routing many of the Lodi forces in the first battle of Panipat. Now, Babur mentions that in his Baburnama that the Mongol settlers in Central Asia were organized in various tribes. And he says that many of the Mongol tribes had no blood relation to Babur, but then they joined him. And so he says that gradually he finds that he has been able to take support of many other Mongol tribes who were not actually blood relation to him. And with their help, he was able to then, create an army of some 10,000, 12,000 men with which he attacked, Delhi and the surrounding region and India. And then he established his the Mughal rule in India. Now, if you read Babur and his Baburnama, cavalry is the backbone of Babur's army. It is the most heavily armored soldier, which is organized in different units with all the different war weapons. And the cavalry actually has facilitated him to take control of different different wars. If you read Jos Gaman's Mughal Warfare also, Gaman's argues for the supremacy of the cavalrymen and the relative insignificance of the infantry in the initial wars that the Mughals fought. So, in fact, there is a very interesting quotation there in Jos Gaman, which says that without his horse, the Mughal soldier was a penniless, as well as honorless figure. So when Babur establishes his empire, he establishes establishes an infantry as well. But, in most of his early wars, he had relied mainly on cavalry. But then, while he fights the later bigger wars, he had to rely on the infantry, which actually helped him in, erecting the forts within the war field, what we know as the field fortification. So, it was basically an act of joining different carts together, and then the soldiers used to take stance from there on. Now this Babur's opponents at the first battle of Panipat Like, for example, Ibrahim Lodi depended on the indigenous mercenaries, as we know, and so most of his soldiers were, the commanders especially were the Afghans. Abul Fazl has mentioned about the war between Ibrahim Lodi and Babur. And if you read Abul Fazl, he deliberately inflates the size of Ibrahim's army to highlight the courage of the Mughal soldiers and the leadership ability of Babur. So he claims that Ibrahim commanded some 100,000 cavalry with some 1,000 elephants. But the Mughals just had some 10,000 cavalrymen. Now, many of the soldiers of obviously Babur were largely they were moving on the horses. Now, obviously they were a great support in the success of the Mughals, early success of the Mughals. But you know, this exaggeration of the number of cavalry that the opponent had, Ibrahim Lodi had, is also, you know, very it's something which is not true, because this is if you read Abul Fazl, he just mentions that it will appear that he is talking about the huge standing army of these Indian rulers. But this is not exactly the standing army. I mean, they were all coming together when the war takes place. So the different group of people who were coming together, joining the army, and then fighting the war against the enemy. So obviously, there is no doubt that the superior firepower and the horse archery that the Mongols had under Babur, they were the main reason for the success of Babur. But this aspect needs to be questioned, that the rulers, like the Afghan ruler like Ibrahim Lodi, had such a huge army. Now, when it comes to Sher Shah's rule, we find that Sher Shah, one of the changes that Sher Shah has introduced from what the Mughals were having under Humayun, because Humayun had exactly continued with the same tradition of army which Babur had introduced. So one of the changes that we find under Sher Shah is that he has introduced this conscription of the Afghans. So basically, it came from the Afghan cultural tradition. So Afghans were compulsorily part of the Sher Shah's army. So this was a case of one of the first cases of conscription in Indian history. So you have some kind of a compulsory service that has to be provided to the state. And so possibly, the mention of a huge cavalry that Sher Shah commanded cannot be doubted. But the figure provided by Tariq-e-Sher Shah is also somewhat very exaggerated. He mentions about 150,000 cavalry, which is also an exaggeration, seems to be an exaggeration. Now, when Humayun actually fought Sher Shah in the two battles of Chausa and Kannauj, mentioned in many of the accounts that the household troops of Babur did not prove loyal to Humayun, because the household troops joined Humayun's half brother Kamran and then Humayun lost many of the battles. So it is said that Kamran provided just some 3,000 people to Humayun when he was fighting against Sher Shah. Now, after being defeated by Sher Shah Humayun, as you know, there he goes back to Persia, then comes back only when Islam Shah is ruling after Sher Shah's death in 1545, and then in 1554, after 10 years, almost 10 years after that, he is able to defeat the Afghans and re-establishes the Mughal rule. Now, emergence of the Mansabdari system takes place only when Akbar comes into picture. And then Akbar establishes the Mansabdari system. We will discuss about the Mansabdari and the other group of people who joined the